My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar, I'd like to thank you for joining us, all of you. I think that so many people registered for this teleclass today in a large part because of the notoriety of our faculty. Dr. Michelle Alpha, I'm not saying Michelle is notorious, but Dr. Michelle Alpha is a regular in teleclass education. This is her third time as a faculty, and the reviews that we get following her teleclasses are always excellent. And she's very well organized, too. I remember the first time that I invited Michelle to do a teleclass, she sent her PowerPoint notes a whole year in advance. Formerly with Wayne State University in Detroit, now back in St. Boniface Hospital in Winnipeg, to give the teleclass, Endoscope Reprocessing, Problem Areas and Prevention Strategies, I am honored to present my friend, Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Well, thanks, Paul. With that kind of an introduction, I'm embarrassed to now, begin my session. Probably notoriety is the appropriate description to use, and Paul can't resist getting a dig at me because I got the years mixed up when he first asked me, and I'm not usually that organized that my PowerPoints are done a year in advance. He didn't mention that in this last one they were quite down to the hour, so I'm not as organized as he would imply. Today's session, I'm going to try and review for the benefit of all of us, myself included, some of the issues about flexible endoscope reprocessing, and I'm going to try valiantly to finish in good time so that we have an opportunity, if there are others amongst the teleconference group that would like to share some of the difficulties that they've had and maybe the ways they've used to solve them. By no means do I know all of the problems that have occurred with flexible endoscope reprocessing. Lord knows there's always a new one that seems to pop up. That's all I can say. We've had a recent one ourselves in the last little while. I've sent two things out in the package to each of the sites. One of them was a copy of the handouts for the PowerPoint presentation, but the second one was a table that I thought might be of use to some of the sites, and it's on the verification of training stages for endoscope reprocessing and is basically designed as a checklist. I'm sitting on a committee in the province of Manitoba, and what we're looking at is endoscope reprocessing, and one of the things that we think is very much missing is the aspect of training of the staff. And as part of that, we're developing a checklist for what things should be reviewed when staff are being trained in how to process flexible endoscopes. But this is a very nice checklist if you wanted to do a competency assessment. And I'm going to refer to it as I go through my PowerPoint presentation. So hopefully your site would have received both of those. And one is just a checklist that may be helpful to you or may not. And the other is today's presentation. The first slide really is just covering the fact that we are going to talk about flexible endoscope reprocessing. And if you can move on to the second slide, really I'm going to make the assumption that pretty much everybody linking in today has a reasonable knowledge of flexible endoscopes, and I'm going to hit the ground running, and I'm not going to do a lot of intro. I'm going to get right into what some of the issues are with flexible scopes. As most of you are probably very well aware, they are semi-critical devices, and the most commonly used methods for reprocessing them are the liquid chemical methods that achieve either high-level disinfection as a minimum, or there are some that are cleared as sterilants. But the main objective being that for flexible endoscopes, particularly in the GI and the bronchoscopy area, that the minimum that should be achieved is high-level disinfection. Now, I've put up on the bottom of this slide a reference, Cohen, and it is probably one of the best reviews I think I've ever read about the clinical risks of infection associated with endoscopy. And if you get an opportunity to get a copy of it, it's actually a very valuable reference because it does cover in a very practical manner a discussion about all the things about risks of infection that are associated with endoscopy. And Dr. Cohen made a statement that I think really epitomizes what I would like to emphasize in today's talk. And so I put a quote of his on that second slide, and it says, his statement is, "These studies emphasize that currently recommended reprocessing protocols have a lower than desirable margin of safety, and that failure is likely if the cleaning steps are not followed in meticulous detail." And I think we all know that cleaning is paramount, but I think this emphasis on the fact that there is a narrow margin of safety when it comes to reprocessing flexible endoscopes, and that's because of the fact that we cannot use robust sterilization methods on these flexible endoscopes, we are forced to use methods that we know do not provide us with as good a margin of safety. That doesn't mean to say that we are putting patients at risk, and it doesn't mean to say that they don't work. What it says is that if we are not anal retentive about meticulous attention every time the scope is reprocessed, the opportunity for a problem to occur certainly can in this area because the margin of safety isn't that wide. Now, on the next slide, what I would like to just touch bases on briefly is I am not going to go into a discourse on all the infections that have been reported that have been related to flexible endoscopes, but what I would like to touch bases on is the fact that published literature documents that there certainly has been survival of microorganisms within flexible scopes that have gone through multiple rounds of reprocessing and have been used on multiple patients. And the two examples that I give you in this third slide, TB or Mycobacterium tuberculosis, there's an excellent study that shows they followed retrospectively, as it turned out, when they started to see TB being transmitted and associated with bronchoscopes. What they did is they went back and they found that when they tracked back, there was survival of up to 17 days of Mycobacterium tuberculosis in particular scopes, despite the fact that they had had multiple rounds of cleaning and reprocessing using what were not unreasonable reprocessing methodologies. And despite those rounds of reprocessing, the scope carried Mycobacterium tuberculosis and transmitted it to multiple patients. And this was actually one of the studies that was the basis for the CDC and the FDA sending an alert around a number of years ago. The second study was the one that came out of Australia and talked about hepatitis C transmission in colonoscopies. And what they documented, albeit retrospectively, that there was a colonoscope that was used on three successive patients within a few days, and that particular colonoscope had actually been cleaned and high-level disinfected between those patients, and yet despite that, they documented using molecular techniques that there was transmission of hepatitis C from the index patient who was known to be hepatitis C positive and three successive patients that scope was used on. What this does, I think, is raise the issue, and it reinforces what Dr. Cohen states, is that there can be survival of organisms within the channels of reprocessed flexible scopes, and of course it raises the issue of whether, you know, is there buildup or biofilm that's being formed within these scopes. Now, the problem that we all have is that whenever we take a sample of a flexible scope and try to address our own internal issues, we're just taking a snapshot or a slice in time, and of course it doesn't give us a picture of what happens over the repeated use of these scopes. And if you keep in mind that some of the GI scopes can be used up to 3,000 times in a year, it's pretty amazing when you think about the potential, the number of patients that certainly can be exposed to a scope. And if there are problems with it, obviously we have the possibility that we could affect a large number of patients. If you move to the next slide, what I thought I would do today is, as an overview, this slide summarizes what I'm hoping to go through in the rest of the minutes I've got left. What I thought the easiest way to do was to break it down into four different stages, because these are very critical stages in the reprocessing of a flexible scope, and the issues at each stage are slightly different. The first stage that I want to talk about is the endoscope itself. Issues related to design flaws and or damage that occurs during the normal usage of a flexible scope. The second stage is really in the reprocessing area, and specifically what I would like to address are issues related to staff training, the automated endoscope reprocessors, issues related to cleaning and tracking, because those are where we have seen problems occur in many centers across Canada. The third stage is really looking at the storage of flexible scopes. It's one thing to do a good job when you're reprocessing them. If you store them inappropriately, all your hard work is for naught if you have stored them under wet conditions. And we're going to talk about valves and channel drying. And then the fourth stage, to my mind, is the bedside, the concept of You take a flexible scope out of its storage cabinet, and you're going to use it on a patient. And the issues associated with whether or not there should be reprocessing prior to the use on a patient. So if you will, that's an overview of what I want to touch bases on as we go through in today's session. If you can move to the next slide. The next slide is entitled Flexible Endoscopes and the Defects. Now, most of you are well aware of the design flaw that occurred with Olympus bronchoscopes and the recall that occurred with them, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a moment. That is one area that most of the time we don't see occurring very frequently because the design of these flexible scopes hasn't changed a lot over the years. There's subtle changes that require different connectors, and there's different designs in terms of the optics and the usage. But in terms of major design flaws, the Olympus recall was probably one of the first that I'm aware of that was truly due to a design defect. The thing that does occur, though, is damage during routine usage, and that's the second bullet on this slide. And the third thing that I wanted to emphasize and bring attention to was the fact that there are different designs among the scopes designed for different function. So, for instance, with bronchoscopes, you will notice if you look in the literature that the vast majority of infection transmissions from one patient to another patient due to a flexible endoscope, the vast majority of those are related to bronchoscopes. And the reason for this, or at least in my opinion, one of the reasons is that if you've ever watched a bronchoscopy being done, there is constant flushing of liquid through the suction channel, and what happens is it gets flushed in to clear the field of vision and then aspirated back out. And so if you think about it, in a bronchoscope, there's a lot of fluid flow going into the patient's lung, and so, of course, if there's anything in the channel of that scope, either from a previous patient or because of contamination during storage, that type of scope, because of the way it's used, has the highest risk of transmitting infection from patient to patient, and that is borne out if you look in the published literature to see where do you see the most significant problems with transmission of infectious diseases. The TB transmissions were certainly in bronchoscopes or have been known to be due to that. Colonoscopes, on the other hand, was fascinating to me. I was talking to our service technicians that look after flexible scopes, and I said to them, which kinds of scopes do you get in the most because they require fixing because they've been damaged? And they told me, and it made sense afterwards when you thought about it, that colonoscopes are the ones that most frequently need repair, and that's because of the torturous path they take as they're basically inserted into the rectum, and then there's this physical abuse as they're, you try to turn corners around the bowel and get up a certain distance into the large bowel. So from the service technician's perspective, colonoscopes are the ones that take the most beating, the most physical abuse, and that's because of the insertion path where they have to turn corners, and there's a lot of wear and tear on them. The duodenoscopes, on the other hand, the ones that are used for ERCP procedures, they're the ones that are side viewing, and they're used for invasive surgical procedures. These ones tend to be the hardest to clean because of the complexity of the side viewing flipper and manipulators used to position the accessory devices. So it's interesting when you even just look at the different design of the flexible endoscopes, there certainly are differences in the issues that surround them. Now, if you go to the next slide, this slide actually is just a summary of information about the Olympus recall of bronchoscopes. I have two pictures in there of the biopsy port. The top one is what a standard biopsy port would look like on a bronchoscope. This is one of the scopes that we have in our institution. And you can see that there's a fairly solid black biopsy port there, and it has a green ring around it. If you look on the bottom picture, you will see the new design that Olympus came up with, and you will see that there's a cap and a bushing that are meant to screw on to the biopsy port, and you end up with a connector very similar to the old model, but the biggest difference is that that cap and the bushing could come loose through regular use. And that was an unexpected thing. Olympus didn't expect that to happen. And in fact, it got so loose that people could actually remove it just with their fingers. And when they did, they found nice green slime surrounding the thread of the biopsy port in and under that cap. Now, you can appreciate that even though the threaded area isn't in necessarily direct contact with the channel, the reality is that as you flush liquid in through that port or you aspirate it out, but mostly flushing it down, you have the possibility that you may pick up some of that material if the housing is loose, and then it would be deposited into the patient's lungs. The text on the left-hand side just documents the sequence of events that occurred. It started in November of 2001, and there was a series of hospitals, some in the United States. Johns Hopkins was one of them. There was also French hospitals over in France that reported a high rate of Pseudomonas infections, and they were all attributed back to bronchoscopes that had this defective, and they had a loose biopsy port. I put the website down there if you want to get more information. But this was an example of a design flaw. The reality is, what could have been done to prevent this from happening? There's nothing that a user could do to prevent this from happening. And in fact, it was interesting to me, the reason it was all put together and the recall was initiated was because infection control was looking at their positivity rates in BAL samples, and they realized that their rates had gone sky high at a certain period of time. And as part of their infection control workup, they went back and found out that it was with the new bronchoscopes that had this defect. So from a user perspective, there's nothing we can do to prevent this, but what we can do is do things like monitor the rates of microorganisms that we're getting from bronchoalveolar lavage samples, and hopefully our infection control practitioners can help us out keeping an eye on that. If you move to the next slide, this will show basically a picture, and hopefully you have one that has the graphics in it. This is talking about endoscope damage. These are pictures that were taken by our service technicians, and they're related to scopes that were being used in some of the institutions here in Winnipeg. The far left-hand side shows a very high magnification of the distal end of a flexible endoscope, and what I'd like to draw your attention to is the kind of corrugated area. That's actually epoxy that they use to seal the very end of the distal end of this particular scope, and what I'd like you to notice is that there is corrosion of that epoxy to the point where you can actually see the underlying, they usually have a surgical thread that they use to actually hold the end of the sheath in place at the end of the scope. Now, to the naked eye, this might not look too bad, but if you think about the fact that patient secretions and materials can get lodged inside that corrosion area, it's pretty obvious that it would be very difficult to then clean that properly and ensure that there was adequate disinfection if microorganisms or patient secretions got in there and get sequestered underneath the epoxy. This is an example of routine use damage that occurs. And the other example I'm showing on the right-hand side is a biopsy port. This is a biopsy port taken off of a bronchoscope, and if you can notice on the inner lip of that port, there are a lot of incrustations and corrosion that has occurred. And again, any roughness like that, certainly organisms and secretions can sequester themselves, and particularly in a biopsy port on a bronchoscope, you are flushing material through that port into the patient's lung, and obviously you wouldn't want to have corrosions on the biopsy port of any flexible scope, but certainly not in a bronchoscope because there's quite a bit of fluid that gets flushed into the lungs. Now, I've put a little box there, and I'm terminating this as, you know, things that we can do as users to try to avoid some of these problems. You know, it's quite obvious that visual inspection, when the service technician saw the biopsy port with all this corrosion, they said it was amazing to them that it hadn't come into them before now because it was visibly obvious that there was a lot of corrosion going on. So one of the things that you can do, and it's certainly recommended in the guidelines, is visual inspection every time the scope is reprocessed, and if anything looks like it's starting to corrode, it should be sent in to the technicians for inspection and repair. The other obvious thing is leak testing. I think most of the institutions are doing leak testing prior to the cleaning of flexible scopes, and this cannot be overemphasized because it indicates if there's any leaks or tears within the channels that may lead to patient material being sequestered. Now, I'm a firm believer that service technicians are a key part of the endoscopy area, because they're pivotal in making sure that there's a very, very thorough inspection of the flexible scope. They not only use the naked eye, but they also use magnifying capacity to double check to see if there's any small areas of corrosion or damage and ensure that these are adequately repaired. So I'm a firm believer that what we should be doing in our endoscopy areas is having some type of quality assurance program in place where scopes may go for a long time before they need repair, but that doesn't mean that there's not damage, subtle damage that might occur to them. And I think it's important that visual inspections, if anything unusual is noted, that it gets sent in to the service technicians for repair as quickly as possible. The next slide, we're talking about that second area that I showed in my flowchart, and that was talking about the reprocessing in the reprocessing area and addressing that first bullet, which is staff training. I've got a picture on this slide that shows a cross-section, if you will, through a Olympus scope, and this is one that has an air water port, a suction port, and a biopsy port as well. Now, one of the areas that has been documented multiple times, and, you know, we are all in the same boat together. No one can point fingers at anybody else because it's happened to all of us. And that's the fact that sometimes we get staff changes, and the individuals coming in actually don't even realize that some of these channels exist, and there's not cleaning of all the channels. Now, for ERCP scopes, one of the channels that is, in the past anyway, was frequently overlooked, were the elevator wire channels. And many people were not aware that you actually did need to clean and disinfect those channels. And I know myself, I've been in institutions where there was no cleaning or disinfection of the elevator wire channel simply because the people reprocessing it, they were spelling off someone on holidays and they themselves had maybe not been adequately trained and they didn't even realize that some scopes do have elevator wires. So it's important that people are aware of all of the channels that need cleaning. Now, one of the other ones that I'm going to show a picture of a bit later on is those scopes that have what are called auxiliary water channels. And I know certainly we ended up sending a notice around within our institutions here in Winnipeg to remind people about auxiliary water channels, because there are some flexible endoscopes, and in particular those of the Olympus design, that may or may not have an auxiliary water channel. And it's critical that that channel is brushed and cleaned in the same fashion that you would the biopsy channel. So the issues about the presence of channels that people aren't aware of and how these can actually be overlooked. And it's easy to do because, as I mentioned earlier, there are many different models of scopes. Some of them have these channels, some of them don't. And if you are not thoroughly trained in all the different scopes, and even if you are, it is very easy to be confused. And so the importance of making sure that all the channels are consistently cleaned and obviously disinfected is of a big consideration. I would say that this problem is one that has occurred on a very frequent basis in many different institutions. In terms of avoidance, the bottom bullet talks about how could we try as users to avoid having these problems. And it sounds really obvious, but I think a big defect in many centers, and again, I take full responsibility too, our center is no different than many others, but the concept of documenting the training and ensuring that the staff who are doing the reprocessing have knowledge of the type of scope being reprocessed. It sounds obvious, it sounds like motherhood, but the reality is that often the training is done on a verbal basis, and the individual who works in that area trains the next person coming in. So it's really important that there is a documented training process. And that's actually where this checklist that I've provided is actually a useful checklist to have. In our institution, when we do a check in the endoscopy area, the infection control nurses will drop in, and one of the things that you want to do, or it would be, I think, very valuable to do, is to verify the competency of the particular staff person with the procedures. Now, the checklist I'm giving you includes the training part of it as well, but even if you limit yourself to those things that are related to the reprocessing, it's a useful checklist. Do they actually know which channels they're supposed to be cleaning? Do they know how to leak test, how to do it, why they do it, and when they do it? Do they know how to disassemble all the valves, caps, and buttons that are on the particular endoscope? And if the staff that are reprocessing it are unsure in any of these areas, obviously retraining them in those is then an important part of the loop. So avoidance of channels not being cleaned, of course, rests very heavily on making sure that the staff are well-trained to begin with and that they have knowledge of the scope being reprocessed. The second one is a review of protocols with infection control. I know I've gone around with infection control sometimes as we've tried to work our way through certain issues, not necessarily in endoscopy, but when you go into a ward in the hospital and they know it's the infection control troop coming around, sometimes the staff look at you as if you've got three heads and wish you would just wither up and disappear because, of course, when infection control comes around, it just makes people think, oh, there must be a problem and we're going to have to do something else. And in some ways that's true, but having your infection control people review your protocols that are used in endoscopy reprocessing is actually a very good way to vet those protocols and make sure that, you know, you're as up-to-date as you can be and that they comply with the recommendations in a variety of the different organizations' guidelines. So reviewing the protocols or submitting them to infection control to make sure that they've reviewed them is actually a really good process, I think, to help avoid lack of knowledge about what should be done in terms of endoscope reprocessing. The other thing that I think is very important is a competency review. And one of the steps in the avoidance bullet that I've got, and I would say that most institutions, and our own used to be in this category as well, that the concept of reviewing the competency, the ongoing competency of staff on a regular basis, is not naturally part of a lot of what we do. If you look at the new AORN recommendation, there's a new guideline or recommended practice that's been published by the AORN. It just came out in February of 2003. It's a reference that's included at the end of my talk in the handout so that you have a way to check it if you want. One of the things that they actually recommend is that there should be competency reviews. And by this, it's not just reviewing what the written protocols are, it's to observe the process. And they are actually suggesting, again, very similar to what we're developing in Manitoba, is to develop a checklist that you observe and monitor whether the staff actually demonstrate that competency in reprocessing of flexible scopes. Now, obviously, if you can do this, you are going to reduce the number of instances where a scope may be inadequately reprocessed because people were unaware of how to deal with the channel or unaware of how to reprocess certain components of it. So in terms of the staff training, I've spent quite a bit of time on this slide, but I think it's one of the more important ones because I think it behooves all of us to spend a bit more time in this area and to ensure that our staff are well trained and that they are demonstrating ongoing competency with this. There is no one in the world that would ever knowingly, incorrectly reprocess a flexible scope. Usually what happens is they weren't either adequately trained or they were unaware of the implications of what they were doing. And as I say, I don't think there's anyone in an endoscopy area that would consciously, knowingly do things wrong. Now, if we look at the next slide is headed by a text that is, again, in the reprocessing area. We're talking about automated endoscope reprocessors. There have been a number of problems that have come up with automated endoscope reprocessors. On the left-hand side in the box, I've given examples of automated endoscope reprocessors. This is by no means a complete list. What I was trying to capture is that we have a wide range of different automated endoscope reprocessors. The high-level disinfectants or the liquid chemical sterilants that they use are different. For instance, the Steris System 1 is a single-use system dedicated to parasitic acid, and it has its own unique little couplets that are the only thing that can be used in that system. The Medivator is a system which can utilize either glutaraldehyde or ortho-phthalaldehyde. There are other AERs put out by Custom Ultrasonics that can use glute or ortho-phthalaldehyde, OPA. And, of course, the Innova 3 is, again, a single-use system that actually uses glutaraldehyde, but it brings it in. Its stock solution is at a high concentration, which it dilutes,
And then there's an AER that's made by Johnson & Johnson, which could use glute or ortho-phthalaldehyde as well. Again, the list is not exhaustive, and it's really meant to emphasize that the different systems can use different high-level disinfectants, and they also have different cycle parameters, and that's what's shown in the right-hand box. Each of these systems, and some of them have newer cycles or more advanced cycles, so just because it's a Medivator, you can't be guaranteed that it does or doesn't have a cleaning cycle that is built into it, or that it does or doesn't have an alcohol rinse. The cycle parameters that I've listed on the right, some of the automated endoscope reprocessors do leak testing. Some actually have what they call a wash cycle, where they have enzymatic that can be dispensed and used in the wash cycle. And the cycle may reuse, or it may have the high-level disinfectant as a single-use agent. For instance, the Steris System 1 and the Innova 3 are both single-use agents, where the chemical they're using for disinfection is a single-shot chemical, and there's no reusing of it. And in addition, those two systems, which I put asterisks on, the issue of the elevation of temperature to make the chemistry more efficient is also a parameter on those systems. Again, under the cycle parameters, most of the AERs use filtered rinse water, and they're filtering it through 0.2 micron filters. And the other thing that may or may not be present on the automated endoscope reprocessor is an alcohol rinse, but most of them have the dry cycle. Now, the reason I'm spending a bit of time on this is one of the areas that has been very problematic recently, and that if you go to the next slide, I've kind of listed some of the problems that have occurred with these automated endoscope reprocessors. Now, these are the current problems that have been listed within probably the last 3 to 4 years. If you've been around long enough, you know that prior to the problems I've listed here, there used to be some huge problems with the non-immersible scopes with automated endoscope reprocessors. Those are pretty much non-existent now, but instead we have another set of problems that seem to have raised their ugly heads. We have immersible scopes, and pretty much all the non-immersible ones have been phased out, but with the immersible ones and the automated endoscope reprocessors that go with them, we have another set of problems. One of the problems that's come up, and this is one that has occurred in a number of different sites, is the wrong connections. And by this, I'm talking about the connecting of the scope channel to the automated endoscope reprocessor. We know that if we don't get fluid flow down all of the channels in a flexible endoscope, you're not going to get adequate exposure to the disinfectant. This process is obviously occurring after you've done your manual cleaning, and you're putting your scope into the automated endoscope reprocessor. If the connection is incorrect, then you're going to have suboptimal or no flow in the channels. And most of the North American automated endoscope reprocessors, there is no way to verify that you're actually getting flow through those channels. So it's often expected that the user is going to have checked the patency of the channels and know that there's at least the ability to flow fluid through them before they're put into the automated endoscope reprocessor. Now, how can we try to avoid that? I don't know about you folks, but I know I've gone into our endoscopy area and I've opened up the drawer where all the quick connectors or the connectors are for the various different automated endoscope reprocessors, and my gosh, it's pretty mind-boggling when you look at all the tags, the labels, the links, the chains, and all the possibilities. And the interesting thing is that every unique scope has its own unique set of connectors dependent upon which automated endoscope reprocessor is being used. So you can't take the quick connects from the Steris system and use them to connect a scope into the Medivator or vice versa. Now, how do you avoid that? It's a real nightmare because just the diversity that's there makes this a very challenging problem. The only way to really avoid it is obviously to review the protocols with your staff and ensure they're knowledgeable. But beyond that, again, the idea of assessing their competency, giving them the drawer full of connectors, giving them a scope and saying, okay, how do you connect this one and put it into the AER? And you watch them and see, did they actually use the correct connectors when they did that? So, and it's a huge problem because there's such a range of connectors that can be used. The wrong connector can result in, again, that margin of safety and result in problems. The second item under the problem list here is the wrong agent being delivered. Now, this has occurred in a number of occasions in Canada, and I'm sure there's lots of opportunities where this has probably happened in the United States as well, where a connection on the automated endoscope reprocessor has either been swapped or the end has been put into the incorrect agent. In many of these automated endoscope reprocessors, there may be a stock container of the high-level disinfectant or a stock container of the alcohol or the detergent, depending on which of these parameters are part of its cycle. And obviously, when you change that and put a new bottle on, there is a possibility there that if you put the wrong hose in the wrong agent, you're obviously going to have the cycle screwed up. And we know there's been several instances where that has happened, and it's easy enough to see how that could happen because the tubing, if it doesn't look any different, it would be quite easy to put it into the wrong container. Now, how do we avoid that as users? I know that the manufacturers of some of the automated endoscope reprocessors have responded to this and tried to make sure that there's unique tubing and bottles with unique connectors so that it reduces the likelihood that anybody could make that mistake. So in short, the tubing may have a connector on it that will only fit in the alcohol bottle or will only fit in the detergent bottle, and in that way you can reduce this from happening. The other thing that has been done to try to reduce this is the idea of having a double check where when there is a change of agents, you have a double signature so that the person who's changing the bottle does it and verifies that they've put it on correctly, and then you have somebody else independently come in and double check that to make sure that indeed it was done properly. Seems fairly redundant, no different, I guess, than us having two pilots in our planes to make sure that if one conks out that we have a backup in place. And having a double check when there are changes of agent made is one way to reduce the likelihood that you will have an error made in a swapped connection. The third problem that's been identified here for the reprocessing of automated scopes is suboptimal MEC. And MEC stands for minimum effective concentration, and by that, if you look at any of the guidelines out there, be it SGNA, AORN, etc., there is a recommendation, especially when you're using a reusable high-level disinfectant, such as glutaraldehyde or ortho-phthalaldehyde, that it's important that when it's being reused, that you test the agent each day that that endoscope reprocessor is being used to make sure that the high-level disinfectant achieves the minimal acceptable concentration or the minimal effective concentration. And there are test strips that will allow you to do this. The recommendations are that you should test the MEC of your high-level disinfectant each day that that automated endoscope reprocessor is being used. Now, obviously, if you're in a small center and it's not being used on a given day, you don't need to test the MEC with your strip, but any day that you are going to use it, you should make sure and test it. And that ensures that despite the fact that it's being reused, that you still have the minimum effective concentration that will give you the appropriate level of high-level disinfection you need. Of course, this is a different issue with those AERs that are using single-shot or single-use high-level disinfectant or sterilant. In those instances, you have a stock solution or a packet cartridge that's put into the machine. It's used once, and the expectation is that it's going to have the minimum effective concentration because you're not reusing it. However, in terms of the double-checking to make sure that that truly is indeed the case, one of the ways that some of the AERs deal with this is they have a chemical indicator that goes in with the load in so that you can actually see there was active ingredient that was actually in the chamber. And an example of that, of course, would be the Stericystem 1. There are chemical indicators, and they indicate that, yes, there was parasitic acid in the cycle. How do we avoid the problems related to reusable disinfectants becoming diluted or inactivated? The way to avoid that is obviously to test the MEC each day, and of course you need to record that you've done that testing, or if you're using a system where there's a chemical indicator put in, you need to record the CI testing results. Now, if you're using a single-shot high-level disinfectant or sterilant, one of the things you want to make sure is to ensure the process cannot be altered. Some of the automated endoscope reprocessing systems are based on the fact that it's a single shot, and the expectation is it's going to have the right minimum effective concentration, providing nobody has altered the process and that each of the containers are properly hooked up to the correct agent so that the correct amount is delivered. So it's important to ensure the process cannot be altered. And that goes back to our problem number two, which talks about swapped connections. If there is a possibility that the process can be altered, then doing something like having a double check is well warranted, because that's a way to make sure that the process hasn't been altered because you had the opportunity to inadvertently swap the connections between different agents in the cycle process. So those are some of the issues related to automated endoscope reprocessing. By no means is this an exhaustive list, but it does identify some of the current problems that have come up and some of the things that we as users might be able to do to reduce the likelihood that this is going to have a, create a problem in our institution. Now the second one, if you go to the next slide, is related to, again, the reprocessing area, and we're talking here about reprocessing or improper manual cleaning. The problems that have been identified, and I've talked about one of these already, and that is the inability to clean some of the channels because people aren't aware that they're there. And if you look on the bottom right-hand side of this slide, you'll see I've got a picture of an Olympus GI scope, and I've given examples of one of the scopes that does not have an auxiliary water channel and one that does. We actually ended up sending a circular around in Manitoba to remind people of this, because it's very easy to see that little knob there and not realize that it even is a channel. And the auxiliary water channel actually has its own little brush, and it needs to be cleaned and disinfected like any other channel. So, of course, not cleaning that certainly leads to problems. And again, how do you avoid that? If you look in the box on the right, it's obviously needed that you review the protocol and ensure staff are knowledgeable that they can identify when there is an auxiliary water channel on a scope and that they do know that they need to brush and clean that channel as part of their routine cleaning for that type of scope. Now, if we continue down our list of problems, the second one that's there is not cleaning accessory devices. And examples of this are channel brushes, water bottle, the tubing, etc. All the accessory devices used with flexible endoscopy procedures need to be reprocessed. And if the rule of thumb you can take from this is that any device that's used, that's going to be used again, needs to be cleaned and disinfected in the same fashion that the flexible scope is being reprocessed. Now, some of us don't even know whether these accessory devices are being reprocessed because, again, unless people are aware of it, they may not even know that they are supposed to do the reprocessing of their channel brushes or their water bottle. Now, obviously, if they're using disposable channel brushes, that's a non-issue, but for people that are reprocessing their brushes, it's important that the brush is cleaned. It can be put right into the high-level disinfectant along with the endoscope so that it can be disinfected as well. And how do you avoid those kinds of problems? The easiest way is, again, involving infection control to audit or observe the actual practices, and that can help identify instances where things may not be being done completely because people aren't aware they need to be done. Now, the final bullet on the problems for improper manual cleaning, the third bullet on the left-hand side, is suboptimal cleaning. Again, you know, nobody's pointing fingers because every one of us has experienced some or all of or some of these problems, but suboptimal cleaning where the endoscope is not being immersed and there's not enough brushing. We all know the pressure that goes on, especially in the GI endoscopy area, and there's a lot of pressure to speed up the turnaround time. And the ability to properly immerse the scope takes time. And if you think about it, there are two very good reasons why this is done. One is to prevent aerosolization so that the people doing the reprocessing aren't unnecessarily exposed to infectious microorganisms, and it's also done to improve the ability to clean. Again, if your cleaning is being done and the scope isn't being immersed, then that would be considered suboptimal cleaning, and that comes out very obviously when audits are done and practices are observed by anyone. Now, if you go on to the next slide, this is again in the reprocessing area, and the problem here that I would like to talk about briefly is the tracking of flexible endoscopes. This presents some major logistical problems. One of the problems in the tracking of a flexible scope is, you know, obviously the scope itself has to be labeled in a way that is a unique identifier. And yes, they all have their serial numbers, but I don't know, I'm getting old. I don't know about you, but I have a hard time reading those serial numbers. So, you know, there has to be some way to actually identify the scope in a way that is unique to that scope so it's easy to identify it. That way you can trace it. One of the ways to avoid this is obviously to label the scope, but how do you trace which scope was used on which patient? Again, the recommendations that are coming out from the guidance bodies are suggesting there should be a master record sheet for tracking scope use, and it should include a patient identifier. It may be the patient name, depending on FIA issues, or it may be an identifier, so that if you needed to, you could track back what patient that scope was used on when it came through at that time of the morning. And also track the scope use and which disinfection machine was used on it. So the second problem that's identified on the left-hand side is the problem of the inability to trace which AER was used for reprocessing which scope. And I can tell you we've experienced that problem here in Manitoba, where we noted that it appeared that there might have been a transmission of organism from one patient to another, and then when we went back into the reprocessing area, we could tell what scope was used on the patient, but we couldn't tell which AER it actually went through. And so, of course, the way to avoid that is shown on the right. If you have a record sheet that tracks the scope reprocessing and includes who it was used on, where it was disinfected, and which side it was used on, it's a lot easier to problem solve when you do need to. Now, the third bullet on the left-hand side under the problems is this issue of damaged scopes being sent for repair. And sometimes, and this has happened, that the scope waiting to be sent out gets used on a patient, and the scope itself hasn't actually been neither cleaned nor disinfected. So avoidance of that obviously requires that the endoscopy area should develop a protocol, number one, to prevent after-hours access to scopes by untrained personnel, because we know a lot of the problems occur after hours when people use a scope, and number one, they may not know that that scope is destined to be sent for repair, so obviously labeling of them to warn them not to use this scope is important. But even so, it's important to make sure that the access to scopes is limited, especially to untrained personnel, but that somebody is responsible for any scopes that are used after hours, because the other problem that happens is if they're used after hours and nobody bothers cleaning them until the next day, it can create a problem. Or if they don't tell the staff that they've been used, the scope can then again be used on a patient and it hasn't been adequately reprocessed. So that's some of the problems relating to tracking of flexible endoscopes. If you flip to the next slide, we're going to move on to storage area issues. And again, moisture in channels, we're all aware that's a no-no, and bugs cannot replicate if there's no moisture. So the goal is to make sure that the scopes are stored very dry. The way to avoid that is why we do the alcohol rinse and drying, and we store the valves separate from the scope. You should never have the valves actually stored on the scope when it's put into the storage cabinet, because that prevents any moisture from final evaporation. The second problem is if there's unknown breaks in the filtration process of the automated endoscope reprocessor, which lead to water organisms being in the final rinse. Now, this is a hugely controversial area. In North America, we don't do any monitoring of the water that's either coming out or going into our automated endoscope reprocessing. In Australia, their guidelines require surveillance cultures, and this is extremely controversial. At this point, I think you'd be wiser to spend your time and money in making sure that your filters are maintained in your AER than spending a lot of effort in doing surveillance cultures at this point in time. The third problem listed here under storage is, and I've had a couple of sites call me about this type of problem, where the scope's been stored for an extended period of time. It isn't used much, and then the issue is, okay, how long can you store a scope before you need to do it by cleaning and disinfection again? And the issue is, of course, you can get fungal growth or bacterial overgrowth in those scopes, and they may be very dusty and full of things before they're ready for their next use. Now, there is a reference here, Riley et al. In 2002, and the maximum shelf life that they established for colonoscopes was 7 days. So when people ask, I usually indicate that in my mind, I think this is reasonable. And if the scope has not been used within a 7-day period and it's day 10 and it's going to be used on a patient, it certainly should be cleaned and disinfected prior to use. Now, I've put a little note here as well. I just want to draw people's attention that there are new storage cabinets. They're available in Europe. I don't think they've made it to North America yet, but they have continuous filtered airflow to all the channels of the scope during storage, and it's on a timer. And I think that's going to help revolutionize and reduce the likelihood that we have scopes being dried that are left with moisture in them. If you move to the next slide, this issue of prior to the next patient use, what are some of the problems? And basically it's to make sure there's no viable organisms in the scope. And avoidance of this is one of the ways it's been recommended, and I was shocked, the new AORN recommendations for 2003 suggest that all scopes should be reprocessed prior to patient use. And that means you're doing them twice. You do them after patient use and then again before they're used on a patient. To be honest with you, in North America, that isn't the norm, and most people store them and then use them on patients and follow the 7-day suggestion that as long as it's within a 7-day period, it's okay to do that. So keep in mind, it could be worse. We could be required to reprocess them all beforehand. And I think that that's it for that slide. If we move on to the next slide, which is just my summary slide, I'm going to try to wind it all up now. What I tried to do in our session today was actually go over the endoscope, some of the issues about it, what problems have been identified, and what we can do as users to avoid them. The reprocessing area, you'll notice that's the one where most of the problems occur, and that's the one you probably want to spend most of your time on to make sure you get your house in order in that area. Storage is a big issue, and it's easy to solve if you make sure that everything is dry and the valves are stored separately. The issue under item number 4, the bedside reprocessing prior to use, I think we're going to see more come out on that, and at this point in North America, that isn't something that's routinely done. So if you go to the final slide, the next one is actually the FDA CDC advisory, and I'm just going to flip over it because really it reinforces what I've just been saying about training of staff and QA programs to document competency. So if we can go to the next slide, which is the conclusion, again, the reminder that with flexible endoscopes, the margin of safety is narrow, and that the key thing here is to get compliance of the actual correct reprocessing guidelines and make sure your staff training is done well. And the third item I've put in is we obviously need some cleaning verification tests for users, and currently there are none. And the very last slide that I want to talk about is just a picture of myself. I know talks like this are frustrating because they make you feel as if there's just yet one more thing you have to look at. But remember, if you don't look, you won't know. And sometimes there could be some really nasty problems out there that you can actually avoid if you take the time to look at them. And on that note, I'm going to stop. The other slides I've got in my presentation were really for information for you, just as a summary.
Michelle, have you heard anything in regards to alcohol being contraindicated for the use in bronchoscopes during the drying process, just before you purge it with air?
We actually did some studies on this a number of years ago, and in reality, the alcohol is only being used to facilitate the drying process. It has the advantage of helping to kill any water organisms if you happen to be doing rinsing with tap water that's not filtered. But to be quite honest with you, the alcohols are harsh on many of the solvents or the glues that are used in flexible endoscopes. And I think it's important to remember that the alcohol rinsing doesn't need to be done in between patient use. Its primary purpose is prior to the scope going into storage to facilitate that you get the scope very dry. I haven't heard anything that contraindicates it, and most of the guidelines still recommend the alcohol rinsing, but I will be honest with you, it's getting the scope dry that's important.
I'm just wondering if there's any guidelines that state the amount of time that a scope can be pre-cleaned and then left without being sent through the AER. For instance, if there's a late procedure on a Friday afternoon and they do the pre-cleaning process and then leave it overnight or for the weekend, is there any guidelines that state that that scope can be left for a day or can be left for 2 days after being pre-cleaned without being sent through the AER?
I would say the guidelines are pretty clear on the fact that it should not be left, and there's no guideline that it gives you a time frame, like says within 1 to 2 hours, but definitely leaving it overnight or over weekend would be unacceptable because when you clean it, you're cleaning it with enzymatics, and the organisms that are there are not being killed, and definitely there's high levels of them. And if you let it sit, it's going to be moist, they're going to replicate, and then you're going to put it into a something like a glutaraldehyde, which will fix all those organisms into the channel. So I would say that the goal is to ensure that if a scope is used, it gets pre-cleaned and through the high-level disinfection and dried before you ever would do anything like overnight storage. And you're posing a problem which we all face, which is what happens when people have emergency procedures and they use them after hours. And the idea that scopes even have had no cleaning and have sat overnight or over a weekend, all of us have had to address. But there's no guideline that I know of that would ever recommend that you pre-clean a scope and then let it sit overnight. They would always recommend that as soon as practical, after you've done your pre-cleaning, it should be put through high-level disinfection, and then if it's going to go into storage, it should be dried prior to storage.
Good. Thank you very much, Michelle, and thank you again for another very well-organized and well-presented teleclass.